C1F. Number 4B.
And then as life, the understanding of the superiority and immortality of soul leads to the recognition of the immortality of man. She takes here Socrates, and you know how Socrates was in the line of the Greek philosophers and scientists, that first one who logically deduced the immortality of man. On the other side of the Mediterranean, we have the prophets who saw through spiritual sense the immortality of man. But Socrates proved the immortality of man through deduction. He said, because being is immortal, man must be immortal. No matter if he had to drink the cup of poison, he said in those wonderful discourses he had on that night with his disciples, he said, that is a joy for me, because the immortality of man is for me a certainty, and to lose the body is just liberating oneself of limitations and restrictions. And he believed very much that through his death he will lose nothing, that this is no loss whatever for him. You see, it's quite a different reasoning than what we had from the biblical side. I always feel that there we have the melting pot on one side of the Mediterranean, the philosophers and scientists, and on the other side, the spiritual seers, the prophets, Jesus and so on, melting together then in Italy, France, England, and then in America, coming together as science and religion into one, because they are not two. Religion and science are one thing. They are two aspects of one thing. Science explains to the human mind the reality of being, and religion explains through spiritual sense the reality of being. But science and religion do not exclude one another. They are both engaged in finding reality on two ways, but both are concerned with one and same thing. And for us, I think it is necessary, if we can meet the demands of our age, that we can wed both into one and see how both coincide, the divine revelation and reason coincide, and that they don't exclude one another. Then we have as truth, she shows here, the truth of immortal sense destroys the errors of material sense and makes body the servant instead of the master. Again, you see, we get the tone of truth, and every time we get to the tone of truth, it's showing that the one true consciousness excludes the other. That really, we don't have to destroy error as if it were something, and with some ways mean we have to knock it down until nothing is left. That the destruction of error is really not a destruction of error, is really taking the right standpoint. And if we take the right standpoint of truth, in truth there is no error, and that's the solution of error. And that shows that truth and error are not dualities. I guess I feel that I must stress that point, that we have not to deal with duality as two opposite entities, but that it is just a dual standpoint which we have to resolve. And that if we resolve that, all sense of duality is resolved by itself. She says, the understanding that the ego is mind, and that there is but one mind or intelligence, begins at once to destroy the errors of mortal sense. Can you hear again what we were been seeing all afternoon? All what she is trying to bring out somehow in this chapter is to show that big mutation of consciousness, to see that there is only one ego, one I. We'll see tomorrow that even clearer and clearer, that we have no right anymore to make any sentence in which the I or we appears, except that I or we is God. That every statement we make in which there is an I or a we, which is not God, is a wrong statement. And that's what the world is laboring today, to come out of the multitudinous of we's and I's and egos into one world. That's its feeling, that there is one world, and from that one world they must deduce that there must be one mind, one I, one ego, or they can't be one world. They can't be one world with 3 billion egos. That's not a universe. It is, as Archbishop said, it's diverse and not a universe. So, little by little, one feels that the aim is not to come out from particularism nearer and closer to one humanity. From there, we have only the jumping off point into metaphysics to see then there is only one mind for all people. No man has a mind of his own, but just one mind. And here, again, she shows that if we really would see that, that there is only one ego, a mind, that dissolves, begins at once, as she says, to dissolve all errors. How many problems would we have if we would believe that there is only one I or ego, and this one I or ego, God? Take any problem you have, and it begins to dissolve if we really begin to see that there is only one I or ego. One I or ego that only knows itself, only reflects on itself, and therefore in soul never loses its identity, never loses what it is. How many problems would we still have afterwards? None whatever. None whatever. I stand in awe before this chapter, because it brings us out, as we'll see tomorrow, it brings us out of the metaphysics of Christian Science into the science of Christian Science, into the absolute Christian Science, into that standpoint where it says your only I are the synonymous terms. You are not a spiritually minded man or woman trying with spiritual ideas to solve 2,500 different problems in your life. You are, I am. That's the only I am. And in that I am, which is mind, and we have that mind, it's the mind, that is the mind of God, the only mind. We can't have another mind. In that mind, we see a completely harmonious universe of ideas. It's all a matter to stay there or to fall away from it. If we stay there, we are in the footsteps of truth. If we fall out of it, we are still in it, but we don't experience it. then we experience harmony as disharmony. Not because there is disharmony, there still is harmony. But we experience then, when we fall out of that standpoint, we experience the wonderful harmony there is as disharmony. We experience the wonderful evolution and progression of being as retrogression, stagnation, frustration, and so on. But there is only one being, the I. It's a terrific chapter. And you can feel perhaps now why I feel I shouldn't go on with the next chapters at the moment, until in a measure we have made this new standpoint our own, in some measure. He says, if man here is governed by the law of divine mind, his body is in subjection to everlasting life, truth, and love. Gosh, how I read these sentences for 20 or 30 years and thought I understood them. And I didn't. It was just looking at divine mind and saying, yes, it is life, truth, and love. But what it means, if we really see, oh, that mind is my mind. It's the only mind I have. Therefore, the only mind there is that mind which governs everything, my body and the universe, as life, truth, and love, self-existent, self-expressed. What the wind of God that blows. Instead of looking up to the synonyms, and to the stars, we look out from the synonyms and from the stars. The world is changing. The world has got to change. Not because I say it, because there is in being eternal truth changes the universe. And we are synchronized with that harmony and with the music of that sphere in the measure as we drop our standpoint outside the one I or us and see there is only one I or us. Last, she says in love, as God forms his own likeness, it is impossible for man to lose his identity. And you have your immortality. See, she begins steadily and steadily by first showing the right standpoint of mind and says, take the right standpoint of mind. Mind is that which has senses. Not your physical senses has really true senses. They are liars. They don't tell you the truth about men. The divine mind has senses. That testifies to the truth. That is the only reality which is told to you in spirit. And in soul it says, and that can never be lost. That spiritual sense is a sense in being and that can never be lost. And therefore that spiritual sense translates your whole concept of the universe. And you see it through your spiritual senses. And as life it says, and that is the immortal universe, the everlasting universe. And that destroys a false concept of the universe. And lastly, it is impossible, therefore, that man can be anything but immortal. He can't. Nobody can make him mortal. However hard we try to be mortal, and the doctors say that we kill ourselves, that man doesn't die, he kills himself. However we try to kill ourselves, man is immortal. Why? Socrates saw something about that logically. The Bible knew about that through spiritual sense. Because being is. And so nothing can be destroyed. What is there to fear? Nothing.